Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with the glory of the Redeemer and his person and work from Octavius Winslow. And last time we continued in chapter 6, which is the glory of the Redeemer in his resurrection. And again, the verses are Revelation 1, 17 to 18. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as dead. And he laid his right hand upon me, saying unto me, Fear not, I am the first and the last. I am he that liveth and was dead. And behold, I am alive forevermore. And in the section we did last time, Mr. Winslow suggested or talked about how each new conversion is not only a trophy of his grace, but shows or it's a manifestation of the life of Jesus. There's the life of pardon and acceptance. And he discussed going to the cleansing blood of Christ often, in the pardoning blood with the resurrection life of our incarnate God. And it's a perpetual life, and that we can continue to go to it. And of course, his life forever is our life continually or forever. And then he talked about it's the life of the righteousness that justifies. So he went over pretty extensively being justified or how Christ's life applies to the justification. It's God that justifies, and it's through the life of Christ. And he talks about the life of faith in a larger area, a few paragraphs about how the faith supports the believer in trials and suffering and bereavement and the things like that. And he gave examples with the apostles, and then so all these things, peace through these things, and everything come through Jesus and his life. And that's where we left off last time. And Lord willing, we're going to continue on in this chapter this time. And I'll go ahead and begin. Mr. Winslow continues, from this subject, many sanctifying, practical, and consolatory lessons are deducible. So is Jesus alive? Then the saints of God are a risen people. What a glorious character is theirs. Mystically, they are risen with Christ from the tomb, and spiritually, they are risen from the grave of death and sin to newness of life. One of the most fruitful causes of a feeble Christianity is the low estimate the believer forms of his spiritual character. Were this higher, were it more proportioned to our real standing, our responsibility would appear in a more solemn light, our sense of obligation would be deeper, and practical holiness of a high order would be our more constant aim. Ours is a glorious and exalted life. Our standing is higher, infinitely higher than the highest angel, our glory infinitely greater than the most glorious seraph. Christ is our life. We are risen with Christ. So by this we are declared to be a chosen and adopted, pardoned, justified, and a quickened people. This is our present state. This is our present character. We bear about with us the life of God in our souls. As Jesus bore about in his lowly, suffering, tempted, and tried humanity, the hidden, essential life, or it was life of his essence, or he is in essence life, so we, in these frail, sinful, bruised, dying bodies, enshrine the life derived from the risen head, Christ, the head of the body, the hidden life concealed with Christ in God. What an exalted character, what a holy one, H-O-L-Y, one, then, is the believer in Jesus. Herein lie the person's true dignity and real wealth. It is that he is a partaker of a divine nature, and that he is one with the risen Lord. All other distinctions in comparison vanish into insignificance, and all other glories fade and melt away. Poor he may be in this world, yet is he rich in faith, an heir, an heir of an inheritance, of the kingdom, for he has Christ. Rich he may be in this world, titled and exalted, yet if Christ is in his heart, that heart is deeply sensible of its native poverty, so the heart is natively full of poverty, even if he may be wealthy in this world, and is lowly and childlike Christ character and has that. If this is our exalted character, then how great our responsibilities and how solemn our obligations. The life we now live in the flesh is to be an elevated, risen, and a heavenly life. If ye be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. So what is this holy, H-O-L-Y, state here enjoined? Heavenly mindedness. And on what ground is it enforced? Our resurrection with Christ. As a risen people, how heavenly minded then we ought to be. How how ill does any other state comport with our new and hidden life? How incompatible and incongruous do groveling pursuits and carnal joys and earthly ambition appear with a life professedly won and risen with the incarnate God? But even here, much heavenly wisdom is needed to guide in the narrow and difficult way. To go out of the world, to become as a detached cipher of the human family, to assume the character, even in approximation of the religious recluse, the gospel enjoins nowhere. To relinquish our secular calling, unless summoned by God to a higher and more spiritual service in the church, to relax our diligence in our lawful business, to be indifferent to our personal interests and responsibilities, to neglect our temporal concerns, and to be regardless, or in other words, not regard, the relative claims which are binding upon us, are sacrifices which a loyal attachment to our heavenly King does not necessarily demand, and if assumed, they are self-inflicted, and if made, must prove injurious to ourselves and displeasing to God. But to be heavenly-minded in the true and scriptural sense is to carry our holy Christianity into every department of life, and with it to elevate and hallow every relation and engagement. There is no position in which the providence of God places his saints for which the grace of Jesus is not all sufficient if sincerely and earnestly sought. The statesman in the cabinet, the legislator in the Senate House, the professor in the chair, and I believe in this case it is actually like a teacher professor, the magistrate upon the bench, the warrior in the camp, the seaman upon the deck of a boat may maintain, even amidst circumstances the most unfavorable and hostile, a high degree of heavenly mindedness and may bear a holy and uncompromising testimony for God and for Christ. Nor is there any sphere, however humble, nor calling, however mean or low, to which the life of Jesus in the soul may not impart dignity, luster, and sacredness. Christianity, through all grades and classes and occupations, is capable of diffusing a divine, hallowing, and ennobling influence, transforming and sanctifying all that it touches. Blessed and holy are they who know it from personal and heartfelt experience. But if we be risen with Christ, what is it to seek those things which are above and to set our affections not on things of the earth? In other words, what is true heavenly mindedness? It involves, in the first place, habitual and close converse with God. Upon no other terms can this spiritual state be maintained. The life of the soul can only be sustained by constant and ceaseless emanations from the life of God. There must be a perpetual stream of existence flowing into it from the fountain of life, capital F, God. And how can this be experienced but by dwelling near that fountain? Of no practical truth am I more deeply and solemnly convinced than this, that elevated spirituality, and oh, what a blank is life apart from it, can only be cultivated and maintained by elevated communion with God. The most holy, heavenly-minded, devoted, and useful saints have ever been men and women of much prayer. They wrestled with God secretly, and God wrought by them openly, and this was the source which fed their deep godliness, which supplied their rich anointing, and which contributed to their extensive and successful labors for Christ. Thus only can the life of God in the soul of man be sustained. Such is the mighty evil by which this indwelling principle is begirt, and such the hostile influences by which its every development is assailed, it is quite impossible that a plant so heavenly and divine, embedded in a soul so earthly and ungenial, can thrive but as it dwells in its own atmosphere, the atmosphere of close intercourse with God. So how stands your soul touching this holy and practical truth, my reader or listener? Perhaps you are at the head of a family whose claims draw largely upon your time, your sympathies, and your thoughts. Perhaps you are a man of business deeply immersed in this world's lawful yet low and demeaning cares. Perhaps you are placed upon a pinnacle of the temple, occupying some post of distinction and honor in the Church of God. One of its builders, zealously laboring upon the external parts of the structure. Or the man of societies and committees, living in the meridian of a controversial, exciting, and bustling Christianity. Has the thought ever crossed your mind that you may all the while be living in sad and awful neglect of secret, close, and real fellowship with your Father? That you may be almost a stranger to closet prayer, closet wrestling, closet transaction with God? It is quite possible that this may be so. Your family, business, profession, even what you would term your religious engagements, may crowd the religion of your soul into the smallest compass of time. Oh, think not that spirituality of mind, even in an ordinary degree, can thus be sustained or promoted in that way. Marvel not at the difficulty you find in maintaining even the holy spark alive. Wonder not at the little real delight you take in drawing near to God, at the growing distaste you find for spiritual duties, at the little life that breathes in your prayers, at the want or lack of power and sweetness in the ministry of the word, at the greater preponderance of your mind and affections to the things that are earthly and sensual. And sensual is just generally anything that pleases the senses. So of your mind and affections to those things that are that in earthly. But the answer is return to prayer. Return with earnestness, with real desire for more heavenly mindedness, for more true and close walking with God, and God will return to you. Return to ejaculatory prayers. Those are just quick prayers that come to your mind that you pray to God along the way of during a day. So return to those, to closet prayer, to family prayer, to social prayer, which I believe would be like if your church gathered to pray. But return to prayer. The way of your return is open. It is a new and living way, sprinkled with the reconciling blood of the great high priest, Christ, now alive upon his throne and leading into the holiest. And the moment you turn your face towards God, you will find his face turned toward you. Let nothing, then, rob you of this precious means or way of advancing your heavenly mindedness. Nothing can be its substitute. Other duties, however spiritual, other enjoyments, however holy, other means of grace, however important and necessary, they can never supply the place or take the place of God. prayer. And why? Because prayer brings the soul into immediate contact with Christ. And immediate in the Old English usually was, well, there was nothing in between. So you're directly within the presence of Christ. Brings the soul into immediate contact with Christ, who is our life, and with God, the fountain of life. Exclude all air from the body, and it would soon cease to exist. Shut out all prayer from your soul, and how can you expect to maintain its divine life, vigorous and healthy? As the total absence of the breath of prayer marks the soul dead in trespasses and in sin, so the waning of the spirit of prayer in the quickened soul as surely defines a state in which all that is spiritual within seems ready to die. So an unsaved person has no prayer, and so that this shows that they're dead in trespasses and sins. But if the spirit of prayer is waning in someone who is quickened and alive in Christ, then surely the spirituality of that person is ready to die. So another means of increasing and promoting eminent spirituality of mind, so the first was prayer, he says, is a diligent and prayerful reading of God's holy word. And this, we fear, is not an element in the Christianity of the many. It defines a duty, sadly, and to a great extent, neglected. The tendency of the age is to substitute the writings of man for the book of God. Let them come but with the robe of religion gracefully thrown around them, and whether they assume the form of history or story or song, they are devoured by the professing multitude and professing Christians. Many of them read those types of things, writings of man, who would deem their spirituality unquestionable. But the divine life of the soul is not to be fed and nourished by the profound discoveries of science, or the recondite axioms of philosophy, or the brilliant flowers of genius, or the dreams of a poetical imagination. It ascends to a higher and a more divine source. It aspires toward the ailments of its native clime, C-L-I-M-E. The bread that comes down from heaven and the water that flows, pure as crystal, from beneath the throne of God and the Lamb, can alone feed and nourish and refresh this hidden principle. Jesus is its sustenance, and the gospel, as it unfolds him in his glory and grace, is the spiritual granary from where its daily food is drawn. To this, it repairs or goes to, and oftentimes pressed with hunger or panting with thirst, weary and exhausted, drooping and faint, and it finds its doctrines and its precepts, its promises and its admonitions, its exhortations and revelations, a feast of fat things, a feast of wines on the lees, L-E-E-S, and of fat things, full of marrow, of wines in the lees, well refined. And thus refreshed and satisfied, the grateful soul adoringly exclaims, "Thy words were found, and I did eat them, and thy word was unto me the joy and rejoicing of my heart." Now truly did Jesus testify, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except ye eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, ye have no life in you." And it's evidently and solemnly implying that there exists no appetite for spiritual food. There is wanting or lacking the great evidence of the life of God in the soul. So where that doesn't exist, and no appetite for spiritual food, there's a great evidence of the lack of the life of God in the soul. A mere semblance of life, an informed judgment, or a fair show of religion in the flesh can content itself with anything short of the spiritual ailment, aliment contained in God's word. A ministry without Christ, without unction or power or profit, P-R-O-F-I-T, the duty and the day rigidly observed without spirit and without sweetness, the monthly periodical, the religious story, the drawing room exposition, may seem to feed the lamp of mere profession, or can keep alive the form of godliness and satisfy a soul utterly destitute of its power, but the divine life of a quickened soul, while it disdains no auxiliary to its spiritual advance, can yet feed on nothing but divine food. The flesh and the blood of Emmanuel can alone meet and satiate its hungering and thirsting. It is from heaven, and its supply must be heavenly. It is from God, and its nourishment must then be divine. Jesus, and Jesus alone, received into the heart, and rested in, and lived upon by faith, is the food of a believing man. Nothing but Christ. Christ is all in himself, and Christ is in all of the means, in all ordinances, in all channels, in all seasons, and he sustains a soul whose life is hidden with Christ in God, and all those things play a part of that. So, dear reader, do you see the importance and feel the solemnity of this truth? Oh, it is a great and solemn one. Except by faith you eat the flesh and drink the blood of the Son of Man, you have no life in you. Your mind content with anything as a substitute for this, your faith standing on the wisdom of men, your sacramental observances, your religion of meats and drinks and diverse washings and carnal ordinances, your keeping of days and months and times and years, or to use great plainness of speech in a subject so momentous, your past submission to the rite of baptism, your present habitual observance of the Lord's Supper, your visible union with the Church of God, so you go to church, all will avail you nothing in the great matter of your soul's salvation without Christ. Does this startle you? Are you alarmed at the discovery? It is, I trust, with the affection and tenderness which the Spirit of the Gospel inspires that Mr. Winslow addresses you. Nothing short of Christ's righteousness, atonement, flesh and blood, Christ in us, Christ without us or outside of us, Christ risen, Christ alive at the right hand of God, yea, Christ all in all, can meet the deep immortal necessities of your soul. You want all that Christ is, or you lack all that Christ is in the matter of pardon, justification, sanctification, wisdom, and redemption? Or you even desire him in those things? If anything less than Jesus had sufficed, if an expedient less magnificent or an expenditure less costly had answered for God and man, then less would save you. But since the incarnate God alone is the Savior of a poor lost sinner, see that you detract not from or add to this salvation by any works of human merit. To return to our first observation, be exhorted to an intimate acquaintance with God's holy word, as supplying a powerful help to the progress of the soul in deep spirituality. And if your time for reading is limited, limit it to one book, and let that one book be the Bible. Let it be the companion of your hours of solitude, the solace in your seasons of sorrow, the storehouse in all your necessities, the man of your counsel in all your doubts and perplexities. Then will your blessed experience resemble that of the psalmist, "Thy word have I hid in mine heart, that I might not sin against thee. This is my comfort in my affliction, for thy word hath quickened me. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet, and a light unto my path. I rejoice in thy word as one that findeth great spoil." He continues, "But observe the exhortation in connection with the precept, set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth." How solemn and full of meaning are these words. To set the affections on heavenly things is to realize the ardent desire of the apostle that he might know Christ and the power of his resurrection. Oh, there is a mighty elevating power in the resurrection of Christ. It is the great lever to a child of God, lifting him above earth, heavenward, To know that he is closely and inseparably one with the risen head of the church is to be the subject of continuous quickening influence, which in spirit, his own spirit, raises him from the dust and the darkness and the pollutions by which he is surrounded, fixing the affections with great ardency of devotion and supreme attachment on things above. Oh, nothing will more sanctify and elevate our hearts than to have them brought under the power of Christ's resurrection. Following him alone by faith from the dust of earth to the glory of heaven, the affections will ascend with their beloved. Where he is, the heart's most precious treasure, there it will be also. And oh, to have the heart with Christ in heaven, what an unspeakable mercy! And why should it not be? Has earth more that is attractive and lovely and holy and worthy of its affection than heaven? Here we are encircled by and combat with spirits of darkness and pollution, principalities and powers. There is an innumerable company of angels. Here we are much separated from the church of God. There, all of the church of God. There is the general assembly of the church of the firstborn, from whom nothing shall divide us. Here the divine presence is often withdrawn, and we are taunted and accused by our foes. There is God, the judge of all, whose presence will be our eternal glory, and who will bring forth our righteousness as the light and our judgment as the noonday, which again is only Christ's righteousness, but it will be brought forth. Here we often hang our heads in sorrow at the imperfections we mark in the saints. There are the spirits of just men made perfect, without fault, before the throne. Here we often lose sight of our beloved Lord. There is Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, never more to be veiled from our view. Oh, then, how much richer and more attractive is heaven than earth, to a renewed and holy mind, each moment growing richer and more attractive by the ascension to its numbers of those, the holy and loved ones of the earth, who have for a little while preceded us to that world of perfect bliss. Our treasure in glory, how rapidly it accumulates. Death, which impoverishes us here by snatching from our embrace the objects of our love, by that same act, augments our riches in heaven into the full possession and enjoyment of which it will, in its appointed time, beneficently translate us. So death takes loved ones from us and us from them, but in heaven, but it's actually the gateway into the full possession of the heavenly enjoyments, and mostly Christ himself. But the sweetest, the most powerful attraction of heaven, let us never forget, is Jesus there, or that he is there. What would heaven be were he absent? Could we, at this moment, rush into the fond embrace of the dearest of the glorified ones and meet not the chief among 10,000, an altogether lovely one, who on earth was more precious to our hearts than life itself? Oh, how soon would its glory fade from our eye and its music pall upon our ear? It would cease to be heaven without Christ. Even on earth, his presence and his smile constitute the first dawnings of that better world. And he who lives most in the enjoyment of this, and oh, how much more may be enjoyed than we have the faintest conception of, has most of the element of heaven in his soul. Aim, then, to cultivate heavenly affections by a life of high communion with God. But there is a prohibition. Set your affections not on things on the earth. It is not the design or tendency of the gospel to destroy or impair any single class of those human affections which God has created. On the contrary, it recognizes, encourages, and strengthens them all. He is the fondest parent, the most dutiful child, the most faithful servant, the sincerest friend, best citizen, whose affections are sanctified and regulated by the hallowing influence of the gospel of Christ. So those things benefit our things here on earth, the heavenly mindedness. It is the gospel experienced in the heart that alone gives tone, elevation, and security to the conjugal, the parental, filial relation, defining and enforcing the duties of each. It is worthy of remark that in the identical chapter which declares the believer risen with Christ and which exhorts him to consequent heavenly mindedness, some of the precepts to which we have referred are thus strikingly portrayed and earnestly enforced. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as is fit in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, provoke not your children to anger, lest they be discouraged. Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men-pleasers, but in singleness of heart, fearing God. Masters, give unto your servants that which is just and equal, knowing that ye also have a master in heaven. So thus closely are the weighty precepts of God interwoven with the sublimest doctrines of his word. And yet there is much solemn meaning in the prohibition, set not your affections on things on earth, worthy of our deepest consideration. The circle it embraces is a wide one. It includes every earthly object tending to inure and impair the heavenly mindedness of him who is mystically and spiritually risen with Christ. That was a solemn charge which, with tears, the holy apostle alleged against some of the primitive professors who mind earthly things, professors of religion, against the sin with which they were chargeable and which rendered their Christianity of so doubtful a character. He warns the Colossians in the passage before us, set not your affection on things on the earth. The prohibition includes creatures, riches, honors, pleasures, yea, every earthly object that would be a substitute for Christ, everything that would render him less glorious to the eye, less precious to the soul, less an object of the heart's holiest, fondest, and supreme affection. Anything that gets in the way of that, affections of the heart even, and being the holiest and fondest and supreme affection. Oh, many a mother has taken the little flower God has entrusted to her and placing it in her bosom has been so elated with its beauty and its fragrance as to forget the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valley. Her affections have been inordinately set upon an earthly object. Her love to Jesus has in consequence waned. Her zeal for his glory has cooled. Her walk with God has been less close. She has followed her Lord afar off. The means of grace have been neglected. Her child has come between her soul and Christ, and presently he has transferred it from her bosom to his own. He has blighted the mercy that tended to supplant in her holy affections the God of the mercy. Now he continues on and he talks about how even ministers can become greater in our affections than Christ. But we're going to go ahead and stop there for this time and then, Lord willing, pick up with that the next time. But until then, go seeking from God to keep your affections toward him. The things of the earth would not really be that important. They would fade away in the light of Christ, and that he would help us keep our minds on heavenly things, his kingdom, his gospel, his people, the salvation of others and people we know. May we be constant in prayer and his word and other means of grace. And may we do so with a purity of heart toward him out of love for him and a desire to be like him. And then may we always keep in the forefront desiring to be with him one day and looking forward to that blessed day. And Lord willing, we will talk to you again soon.